Kansas City. John Grayson and Rob Ross once again coming to you live from wherever it is we come to you from every week to do this show and put this whole thing together. Rob, how's everything in New York?
Everything in New York is as it usually is. It sucks. New York sucks.
What's the matter?
It's just a terrible place to live. It's overpriced. It's overrun with tourists. And I just hate it here now. So everything in New York sucks.
Well, I'm glad I asked. Meanwhile, well, St. Louis is going through...
Life is great. Let's keep that in perspective.
Right, right. And meanwhile, St. Louis is going through all the crap it normally does around this time of year, which mostly has to do with the weather. So as we continue to power through, you had the opportunity to go out this week. What did you go see?
I went to see the Posies. John Auer and Ken Stringfellow do their 30th anniversary show at City Winery. And while it was advertised as an acoustic set, they really didn't use acoustic guitars. I'm just trying to make that very clear distinction. If you say acoustic set, you know, bring out the 12-string.
Right.
Not nitpicking it. I'm just saying as a, you know, point of parliamentary procedure here.
Point of order.
Now, the fact is those two are so good, it's not even funny. And apparently they had been partying a little too hard with Wesley Stace the night before in Philadelphia. So they were hurting a bit. It didn't show in their performance, just in their very humorous commentary and dialogue in between songs. My only grievance through the whole show is that after every song they would have to retune, detune, untune, whatever, their guitars. Guys, bring guitars as extras so that way you don't have to do this kind of shtick.
Right.
You know? I know it's a minimalistic kind of tour with just the two of you and your two guitars, but if you have three or four, you don't have to worry about this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got more than a few guitars, and I'm not rolling in the kind of Posies cash that they are.
Yeah, I mean, you and I still don't have albums out there that people revere.
Right.
This case, anyway, I guess people really liked Failure. The one that I first caught on to, of course, was Dear 23, their major label debut in 91. And that's what, now 27 years ago?
Yep.
But 27 years is a nice long time, you know. It's 30 years since the first Punchline single came out, and only a smattering of people worship and revere it, as they should. But, you know, there's kind of a difference. You know, they're rolling in the proverbial ducats, which I don't have.
Right, exactly. And yet somehow we can still find the odd guitar on Craigslist that makes the list.
Right. Well, I don't sell my unless I have to, but there's just no more room in here. But anyway, the show was terrific. You know, interestingly enough, they did skip over the songs that most people would know them by. They skipped over Dream All Day and Going, Going, Gone. And interestingly enough, they did not do I Am the Cosmos.
Huh.
But at the same time, they certainly gave me a lot of joy by doing a note-perfect and really beautiful rendition of Suddenly Mary. You know, they did Definite Door and Solar Sister and You Avoid Parties, which is another personal favorite of mine. The show was terrific, and when they were called out for the encore, first they had a couple of friends come out and join them, these two female singers whose names I just didn't catch.
Yeah.
On two songs. And then I just heard these kind of familiar sounding strums before they actually kicked into it. I was like, okay, here it comes. The first one was September Girls, which had the crowd singing along. So that, and of course, yeah, I got tears in my eyes.
Of course. How can you not?
It's impossible for me to not, you know. Let's not forget John and Ken were in Big Star from 1992 until Alex Chilton's death in 2010. They were in Big Star longer than Big Star actually existed at the beginning.
Right.
So I hate when people make those weird suppositions that that wasn't the real Big Star, you know. Big Star was always, obviously, as the band began to shrink, was always Alex and Jody. And right. Alex and Jody were in this band, along with John and Ken. And 17 years is a hell of a long time. But it was the next song that they did, and I saw them put the capos up on the neck, and I said, oh, I know what they're going to do. The two of them walked to the edge of the stage, so there were no mics there, and they did 13 without mics. And you could hear a pin drop.
Yeah.
I wept like a baby. I mean, it was beautiful. It was absolutely spot on. And God bless him. For the first time in seeing anybody try that song live, they did it in the right key, the way it's supposed to go. Everybody, every time that I see somebody do a rendition, always seems to fuck with the key. I don't know what it is or why it is, but they just do. But they got it right. And it was beautiful and it was touching. So
yeah,
God bless the Posies.
There's something great about that. When a band comes out and they turn all of the electronics off, all of the microphones and everything else, and just sing to the crowd, the way that they would have done it 100 years ago. That's a moment.
And the fact that they weren't using acoustic guitars, but they kept it toned down enough that the guitars sounded clear and not muted, but their voices rang out.
Yeah.
That's the kind of room it is. That's a great room.
Yeah, one of these days, I've not made it to any of the city wineries. I know it's a franchise now that I don't know how many of them there are, but I've got a bunch of friends who play the one in Nashville all the time, and they say that's a great room, but there's nothing that compares to the one in New York.
You could definitely make it to Chicago if you wanted to get a fix. Yep. So that's, you know, that's always an option. But yeah, a terrific show and a great night out. And again, you know, here's to 30 more years of the Posies. And let me tell you something. Ken Stringfellow is one hell of a live singer. I mean, if you think they're good as a duo, and usually it always sounds more like John Auer is taking the leads, but boy, oh boy, when Ken sings, he's got some powerful voice.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, and that's, you know, it kind of leads into the fact that just over the course of this week, we heard about a couple of retirements from rock and roll that are huge names, and they did it for very different reasons. And one of them is just quitting right away, that being Neil Diamond. And the other one is going off on a 3-year farewell tour. And we all know what farewell tours are like. They last until the money does, and then there's another farewell tour. So who knows what Elton John's going to do. But the fact that now, you know, add on top of that, we've had another couple of guys who say, look, I just can't do this anymore, and hang up whatever it is, the guitars, the drumsticks, and walk away. It really is getting to that point now where all of these guys that we revered and grew up revering are now in their mid-70s, and it's time for a lot of them to say, you know what, it's just, I can't deliver to the audience what I want to anymore.
Well, it's true. I mean, unfortunately, age catches up with everyone.
Sure.
Duh. But our generation, and maybe the one right before it, are the first ones to see their rock and roll idols. And I'm using the phrase rock and roll in that sense, from going back to the very beginning. Their rock and roll idols, if not obviously dying, then reaching that age of, you know what, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways, you know what, maybe it is better that some retire. Now, in Neil Diamond's case, and I love Neil Diamond, it was very sad to see that, you know, he too has Parkinson's, and that's why he's hanging it up and doing so immediately. But understandable. He's also, what, 77 years old now? Yep. 77 is not a young man. You know, I'm sorry, when people do that thing of, oh, but 77's not that old. No, it's old. I'm 53. I have an AARP card, which I use, okay?
Right.
I've had it 3 years now. Don't think I don't use it when I go to Dunkin' Donuts or I check out, you know, hotel prices.
Yeah.
I weigh the odds of using that or my AAA card.
Well, and not only that, I mean, these guys are in their mid-70s and touring is a young man's game. I mean, touring is a bitch when you're 25.
Going on vacation when you're 77 is a bitch.
Right.
God's sakes.
So, yeah. I mean, and it is sad with Neil Diamond's fans. And I know you're a big fan. I'm not. His music, for whatever reason, just never spoke to me. And yet, he's one of those people, and we've talked about this I don't know how many times, that it doesn't matter. I mean, if anybody tells me that they don't respect Neil Diamond as a performer, I will argue that shit with him, because he's an amazing performer. And to see that many fans who have been touched by that now, unfortunately, because of time and the disease and everything else, denied the opportunity to see him live again, that sucks no matter who you are or what you like to listen to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I went to see Neil Diamond in 1986. I didn't care, or 85, whatever it was. I don't really care that at that point, you know, I was certainly in my throes of trying desperately to be cool.
Yeah.
I loved Neil Diamond since I was a child. You know, in fact, I grew up wanting to be one of two things, either a lawyer or Neil Diamond. Both of them are completely applicable because I'm a Jew.
Right. From
I can do either one. Be that as it may, I loved Neil Diamond from the time I could walk. I mean, this is the guy who wrote, never mind that he wrote I'm a Believer for the Monkees.
Right.
That's a completely separate entity. But he wrote Shiloh, Solitary Man, Kentucky Woman, The Boat That I Row, you know, Thank the Lord for the Nine Time, You Got to Me, you know, and then, yeah, onto the more pedestrian shit like Cracklin' Rosie and, you know, Sweet Caroline and Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show and I Am, I Said. The guy wrote songs that stay with you for an entire lifetime. And yeah, by 1986, he was peddling horseshit like Forever in Blue Jeans. And I will never forget Heartlight.
That's, oh, yeah.
That's an impardonable thing. But he's Neil fucking Diamond.
Right.
And that's all that needs to be said.
And the one time that I got to see him perform live was after a soccer game. They used to do this thing when the Tampa Bay Rowdies still were big enough to play in the NASL, the what was then the Major League Soccer in the United States. They did these shows every 4th of July, and they would have the Groons come down and do the fireworks display. And so they'd play the game. And then a special guest had come out and play a concert. I saw Chuck Berry do one year, and this is 1981, 82, 83. So Chuck Berry did one, Neil Diamond did one, and that's where I saw him. It was the only time I've ever seen him live. And he did maybe four or five songs, but it was in that Coming to America era. And so that one just blew the roof off the place. But that's what I mean. You know, okay, so I've got bands that I like better. So what? That was a hell of a show. And it was a hell of a show leading into fireworks. And people were still blown away by it.
And you were a kid, so it's understandable that's what you're going to enjoy. Now, going on to the flip side of one of his contemporaries, funnily enough, an old label mate of his on Uni Records, Elton John.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Reg Dwight decides he's going to hang it up because, quote, he's getting old and he wants to stay home and watch his kids grow up. Note to Reg, 3 years on the road means you're going to miss a hell of a lot of PTA meetings.
Yes.
I'm just saying, you know.
Right, right.
Nevertheless, I saw the last time I saw Elton, believe it or not, was 1984. Again, this is my I'm too cool for the room period. You know, we're talking, this is right after the Summer of the American Underground thing happened.
Yeah, right.
So I'm, you know, neck deep in Husker Du and the Minutemen at this point. But my father's boss's nephew was the person who came up with the ad campaign for Sasson Jeans when they used Sad Songs Say So Much. And they used that song as Sasson Say So Much.
Right.
So we got tickets to sit 7 rows from the stage or 4 rows from the stage at Madison Square Garden. Now, whether you're too cool or not, you're sitting there going, holy shit, 4 or 5 rows from the stage at Madison Square Garden to see Elton John? Fuck yeah, I'm going.
Yeah, right.
And I went, and this was 1984, and he gave you 3 hours. Easy. I mean, name the goddamn song, and he did it. And that's not a joke.
Yeah.
Really, you know, he did everything at that point that he had, you know, Hey, Hey, Johnny, Empty Garden. He did, oh God, he did I'm Still Standing, which I hated that song. That's that's M.O.R. Elton that I can't take.
Right.
But, you know, stuff like Little Queenie and, you know, and of course all the early stuff, you know,
right.
or the stuff at that point we'd grown up with, like, Someone Saved My Life Tonight, and Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, and The Bitch Is Back, and, you know, of course he did good. The thing about Elton John is he always obliged the audience. He doesn't not give you the greatest hits.
Yeah. Well, and that's he's certainly got a lot of them. And even outside of the ballads, I mean, for guys like you and me who are always too cool for the room, tell me a song that rocks harder than Love Lies Bleeding.
Well, I mean, he ended the show. Absolutely ended. After 3 encores... with Crocodile Rock.
Right.
And I'm telling you right now, the audience was dancing.
Yeah.
You know, think about that. After 3 hours, you're exhausted from watching somebody, let alone the performance, and the crowd was dancing. I'm left wanting for more.
Right. Well, and now on the heels of the announcement of the 3-year retirement tour for Elton John, and, you know, good for him. Let him make a whole shitload of cash on the way out the door. Fine. He's earned it. He deserves every penny of it. But now,
congrats, excuse, Sir Elton John. I don't need to say more than that.
Right. Exactly. So on the heels of all of that, we find out that Neil Peart is now saying exactly the same thing. And I mean, the amount of... You look at what it's done to, or what it did to Prince, and the fact that he was taking all of those drugs because the tour and the touring life and playing and jumping up and down on stage had beaten the shit out of him over the years. And the same thing was true of who else did we see just have that? Oh, Tom Petty. Right. Dying of a fentanyl overdose because, well, he had broken his hip and still needed to tour. So now
both of them with the hip problems.
Right.
Prince with the hip replacement.
Exactly. And so for Neil Peart, a drummer, to come out and say this, I can't imagine the kind of just absolute miserable beating your body must take doing the kind of stuff he did every night.
You know, it's not surprising because there's this documentary that's been circulating for about a month, almost 2 months, on the Showtime networks. I think it's called Rush, Time Stands Still.
Yes, right. I've seen the ads for it. I've not seen it.
Towards the end, it's more than an intimation that this is the end.
Yeah, right.
If anything, I think this, I don't know, I don't understand why people didn't seem to grasp that this was their way of saying it's over. But I'm not surprised, and good for him. A, he should not put his body through any more pain. Second of all, as a human being, he's been through hell twice over and back. To see his daughter die in a car accident, and then his I believe she was never his wife, but his girlfriend, and the mother of his only daughter, dies of cancer just a few short years later.
Yeah.
Forget it. Go and enjoy your life. You've been given, you know, the second run now.
Right.
Go enjoy your life. You've worked really hard for 40 plus years.
Yeah.
And that's one hell of a long time.
Yeah, and the work itself, I mean, not only does it speak for itself, but even outside all of the flashy shit, and he could certainly be flashy like almost no other drummer could, where you had guys like Keith Moon who were just crazy beaters and incredible at it, but Neil Peart was always very precise and enjoyed fucking around with it a little bit. You know, he was bringing some jazz roots. He effectively set the template for prog rock drummers. And, you know, what gets lost in the flash is the fact that he was just incredibly solid. And without him, Rush isn't Rush.
Well, the thing about him also is the fact that he came in as a replacement. He wasn't an original member.
Right.
And if he hadn't come in, who was going to write those songs?
Exactly. So, yeah.
Think about it. I mean, that there's an even greater implication there had he not joined the band. But, you know, again, it's 40 plus years of success for that band. It's 46 years if you total up the years of them going under Rush as a trading name and having records out on the market, right?
Right.
You know, at this stage, we're also talking about 40 plus years of punk rock, which leads me to want to talk about the next person, because this wasn't a retirement. This was I hate to say it, but an almost foregone conclusion when news trickled out in November of him suddenly taking ill and having to cancel all tours and performances. But we lost Mark E. Smith of The Fall this week, and he was someone whose music I just absolutely loved. Now, for those who aren't familiar with The Fall, it's very, very simple and very, very clear. It's one of two poles that you will fall under. You either love this band from the minute and you just get it and embrace it, or you hate it with an unbridled passion, because The Fall was like, it's like listening to Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band.
Right.
There's a weirdness and an abrasiveness, and there's an untunefulness that makes this really beautiful. The thing about Mark E. Smith was, in that abrasiveness came along his very, very trademark and very original voice / vocalizations, because it wasn't exactly singing.
Mm-hmm.
And a way with words that defied all the rules of a songwriter / frontman for a band. And he was also known as the most ruthless of all band leaders. Quote him, "If it's me, your granny and bongos, it's The Fall."
Yeah, right. Yeah, a little bit of an ego there. But yeah, like you said, he earned it. And it was the wordsmithing that attracted me to The Fall in the first place. And I am all for an avant-garde performance as long as there's something underpinning it. And clearly, the man had something to say.
And they had it for 41 years.
Yeah.
Until his death this week, because they put out their first single in 1977. And, you know, they went through their different phases, that first inept punk phase to the more abrasive, more avant-garde style. And they were in their, quote, rough trade years when they put out things like Totally Wired, which was the first thing that truly put them on a Universal map. That was the first one that got to me, because it got airplay like crazy over here. to the more poppy years when they moved over to Beggar's Banquet Records, but that also saw them bring in his then new wife, Laura Elise Salinger, aka Brix E. Smith, on lead guitar and co-songwriter. She brought an element of structure and pop to that band that they didn't have before, and suddenly took a good and interesting band and made them even more interesting and so much better, because now they were actually radio friendly and palatable. For the first time, you could digest and really sink your teeth into the Fall. And even though she left in 89 and their marriage ended, he continued with that band. He continued forward, basically releasing an album every year. I mean, this was a guy that did not tire out at all. And yet when you saw him in interviews, he was always very funny, very charming, he came off as actually very warm, and certainly in America, that's one thing I noticed, versus England. And from my perspective, because I loved the Fall and they were important to me at one time, very important, you know, it's certainly a loss for me. But again, and I don't think this is jaded of me, we are of an age. You and I are of a numeric age, and our friends and contemporaries around us are of that numeric age where we are going to start to see our punk idols dying.
Yeah.
Those who are not that much older than we are. I'm 53. Marky Smith is only 60. Now at this stage of life, that's not a very big gap.
No.
You know, mortality is right in front of me, you know? And I don't mean that to sound like a fatalist. It's just that this is kind of personal, no different than losing Grant Hart and Tommy Keane and Pat D'Anizio.
Well, yeah, and there's another – before we get into the new music this week, there's another thing that happened that just yesterday or the day before, my lovely bride came up to me and she said, do you know any of these people? And she handed me the lineup for Coachella this year. And I knew Eminem and I knew Jamiroquai. And there were
wait, hold on. He's back?
Yeah, believe it or not. Virtual Insanity. Stevie Wonder Jr. is going to be playing Coachella. And there were probably 40 other bands, and I had never heard of any of them.
I've seen a lot of those fake Coachella posters, which I always find really hilarious.
Maybe that's what it was. I hope so.
By the way, Binky Phillips did one that's just hysterical with all these made-up names of bands. It's brilliant. Wow, JK, a.k.a. Psst, he's a Jew.
Yeah, right.
I actually really like the Synchronized album, the one that had Can't Eat? Was that the name of the song?
Yes, right.
That's a fucking great album. That is just such a funky album. And I mean in the right way of funky albums. But Eminem, well, that's – and this is supposed to be a rock and roll festival, is it not?
I guess. I mean, maybe they've just decided to go off in a completely different direction, because I even saw – part of the lineup for what's the one in Tennessee, Bonnaroo. And it also was nowhere near in terms of the, you know, the people that have been there before. It was nowhere near, the same kind of music. I mean, everything was different.
You know what? It's not surprising, because my friend Jen and I usually plan on going up to see the, Mountain Jam. And the last couple of years were people like Gary Clark Jr., Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Grace Potter, you know, rock/jam band, you know, people that you know who are on that circuit, right?
Right.
This coming year, we decided to skip it. We both looked at each other like, who? Who?
Right.
So maybe it's just this year in particular that the offerings are just not that good.
No.
And they're certainly not worth the money that people are expecting to pay for it.
And since you said I might have gotten caught up by fake news, it is possible, but I was just looking down the lineup from the Coachella, their official website, and David Byrne's name is on it, so it can't be all bad. But yeah, there's
boycott, BDS, boycott.
There's a whole bunch of shit that is just things I have never heard of. Fleet Foxes I've heard of, I couldn't name a song. And yeah, some of these others I just have no
for about 1 minute.
Yeah, no frame of reference whatsoever. So yeah, all of the music festivals we invented have now been usurped.
Well, then you know what? It's time to – well, you know, we're too old for festivals. I'm too old to be, you know, camping outside amongst the stench of marijuana, which makes me nauseous. And, yeah, I'm not a pothead. So unlike a lot of people I know who seem to carry that on, it's like, wow, you're how old now?
Yeah.
And you're still You still a dope fiend?
Well, it's funny you should say that because I had my first experience with some of the, shall we say, some of the offerings out of the great state of Colorado. Not in terms of the green leafy stuff, but in terms of some of the candies and the things that are now being made from it. It's interesting.
You know what? The closest I'll approximate to any kind of weird sense of euphoria is if I have to, because I'm in crippling pain, I'll take a couple of Doane's back pills along with Advil at the same time, and it creates a very interesting euphoria. An uncomfortable one, but an interesting one nonetheless.
Yeah, there's nothing uninteresting about euphoria. So that said, there is some new music on tap for this week, and there's something that, you know, again, a name from the past that I didn't expect to hear from. Steve Barton is back.
Oh, hell yes. And if you don't know who Steve Barton is, then shame on you. And we're good at this on this show because we're into public shaming, because people like to shame others all the time. But we're doing it because you're an ignorant asshole and you don't know what you're talking about and you don't know anything musically. And we're here to not help or instruct, but to eliminate the musically retarded.
Yes.
We're just here to get rid of you, okay? Because you just don't belong on the planet. Steve Barton has been the lead singer, main songwriter, guitarist for the wonderful band Translator since the late 70s, early 80s. If I really have to spell out who Translator are, okay, a song called Everywhere That I'm Not was everywhere
yeah.
that we were in 1982.
'Cause I thought I heard your voice in a bar making a choice. But no, it was just someone who sounded a lot like I remember you do. 'Cause that's impossible, that's him. That's impossible, that's him. You're in Tokyo, but I'm not. You're in Nova Scotia, but I'm not.
Followed by some pretty amazing singles like Unalone, Come With Me, Necessary Spinning. They put out four magnificent albums. There was Heartbeats and Triggers, which was the first album. There was a self-titled one in 1985. I can never remember the name of the album from 1983, the red cover.
Right.
The one that had Unalone on it. And then the last album, which actually is my favorite overall album by them, Evening of the Harvest. No Time Like Now, I think, was the second album, but don't quote me. In any event, Steve's put out a lot of solo records over the years. He's, you know, probably one of the best ones he's done, in my opinion, was Charm Offensive. That's a great title anyway.
Yeah.
There's The Boy Who Rode His Bicycle Around the World. Well, this new album, the new album that's coming out, because it's not out yet, is going to be called, because I'm holding it right here, actually.
Tall Tales and Alibis,
Tall
right?
Tall Tales and Alibis. And this is a, get ready for this, triple album / triple CD.
Wow.
Okay. But we have an exclusive song premiere on Pop Dose called Before I Get Too Young. And by the way, Translator has reconvened. They put out a new album last year.
Oh, but good. Okay.
Nevertheless, Before I Get Too Young is this great poppy single.
You can pull back all the layers one by one by one by one, yeah, but there's so much we'll never ever want to reveal. Gonna move myself to Paris, taste your foreign tongue before I get too young.
Almost every, you know, instrument on this track is played by Steve. All you have to do is hear it, you know? And if, you know, again, if you know Translator, you're going to love this because it's Steve Barton, period. You know, this is an album that's going to be, I think it's going to be a lot of fun because there's a lot. Now, people always have their moments about double albums, but he did it in a very methodic way where there's the pop songs that he's playing on. Then there are the songs that he's got other people helping out, like his bandmate David Sheff on drums, or Pete Thomas from the Attractions, you know. Nelson Bragg, who plays in Brian Wilson's band. Derek Anderson, you know, bass player supreme. You know, these guys actually appear on the record during some of the other sections of it. Look for this record when it comes out, which will be March 2nd. In the meantime, go to Pop Dose, look for it, Before I Get Too Young, Steve Barton of Translator. This is a good one.
Yeah, it's a terrific song. I love the fact that it's as stripped down sounding as it is. And yet, again, it's clear that there's a lot of work that went into it. It doesn't sound half done, but it sounds like it's very lean, I guess is the best way to put it. And it should be. It just sounds great that way.
There's also, interestingly enough, with this particular record and some of the other songs that I've already heard from the album, the one thing about Translator that I always really liked in a lot of Steve's solo material, there's a lot of angst in there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there were a couple of buoyant and uplifting moments out of Translator, but more often than not, it seemed like there was a bit more of the, I guess I'll use the word as much as it pains me, angst.
Right, okay.
But this is kind of a lighthearted song, don't you think? It's kind of fun and it's got that... It's got that dare I say it, that jaunty popness about it, which I think is great. You know, it's a great thing. It's just that you wouldn't have expected it out of somebody, if you followed his career as I have, you know, that kind of a track record.
Yeah, right. Nobody listened to a lot of the early stuff from Translator and went, jaunty. So
right. I mean, Everywhere That I'm Not is kind of wry and funny angst.
Yeah.
If you will.
Yeah, but you know? It's great. And, you know, you reminded me because you said something about bass players. I was going to tell you this story. My good friends at Killer Vintage Guitars here in town, I go in there all the time and bother those people and do the same thing that everybody does in guitar shops. Pick up something I can't afford, play it for a little while, go, and then hang it back up on the shelf. I was in there a couple of weeks ago and they had brought out this guitar. The word barn find or the term barn find is something that's usually relegated to cars, but they had one that fit. It was a Lefty Fender Jazz Bass from about probably 1972 or 73. And this thing had literally been found in a barn and had been there so long that under the bridge cover, some small animal had built a nest in there. So there's like hay and hair and shit stuffed up in there. And so they had to take this thing out and clean it off. And I went back in this week and it was hanging up and it looked much better than it did when it came out of the case. But there was something that it just, again, it showed that sort of passage of time in a very strange way, because Fender back at that point, when you bought a guitar like that, they would give you a Fender strap. And whoever it was that put this guitar away, and it was, if you know the guitars, you know, it was like a black check and then a check with the Fender logo in it and then a black
And it had the guitar head on there. There was always a guitar head with a strip through it.
Right, right.
Design. I know because my Fenders all have those straps. And you can actually buy them now, by the way.
Oh, cool.
In different colors. It's no longer the standard black and gold and white as it used to be.
Right.
Now they come in blue and this and that, and so I have a couple in varying colors.
But when they put this guitar away and closed the case on it, whenever that was, probably around 1975, they left the strap in there and they left it across the guitar. And it reacted with the shellac that was on the outside of it, and it ate its way through a good portion of the original finish. So outside of that, the guitar looks fantastic, but you know, it's one of those things you never, ever think about. How many guitars have you seen that before they knew neoprene reacted with polyurethane, they would hang them up on those neoprene hooks so you get these two brown marks on either side of the nut at the top of the guitar? They don't make those anymore, which is good, but for a long time, they look like cigarette burns, and that's what everybody always called them, is, oh, you got a cigarette burn. But that's not what they are. It's from hanging on those hooks.
What I always hated about whenever I go to guitar stores, that was my one grievance, is, oh man, I hope there's not a guitar that's hung up that I want, you know?
Yeah.
I'd rather be one that's on the floor.
Right.
You know, I think the last one that I actually got off the wall, as it were, was my Rickenbacker. And thankfully they'd only just put it out there this morning, that morning. So it hadn't been hanging long enough to be tainted in this way.
That reminds me, you talk about getting him off the floor. Have you been to House of Guitars up in Rochester?
No, sir.
Oh, best guitar shop in the entire world. And the first and only time that I went in there during the 80s anyway, I went in and they had billed themselves as, you know, if we don't have it, we can get it, but we probably have it. and it's an old house. It really is an old, like, Victorian style house. And you walk in, and there's cases, and there's lining the floor two levels high. There are these, like, bookcases that are built into the walls that just have guitars stuffed in them. And so I asked the guy, I said, all right, well, if you've got everything, where's the Gibson double necks? And he said, oh, they're over there, and pointed into the corner. And I went, they? And sure as shit, they had probably five or six of them, white, the original Heritage Cherry, you know, whatever color you wanted, it was back there. And they were just tossed in a corner. That place was great.
You know, I got to say, a double neck guitar, as cool as it looks and as badass as you may feel, that's one of those guitars you have to know how to look cool with it. Because if you don't look cool, no matter how good of a player you are, you're going to look like a dick.
Yeah.
That's one of those guitars that when I strapped it on me, I looked like a dick.
Yeah.
There are five, you know, that one. The Gibson Explorer makes me look like a dick. The Flying V makes me look like a dick. Believe it or not, the Gretsch Tennessean, I look like an awkward dick.
Really?
Yeah. Oddly enough. Huh. I can play the double cutaway Gretsch, no problem. But the Tennessean, I just kind of look like a dick.
That big that white hollow body, yeah.
Yeah. And never give me a double neck guitar.
Well, the thing about the Gibson Explorer is, and you know this if you've had one hanging on you even for the first 5 seconds, there is, I don't think there has been a worse balanced guitar ever. That headstock is ridiculous, and it's heavy, and it drags the guitar down. So every time you let go of it, down it goes.
And the funny thing is, though, even though I knew I was taking a very calculated risk when I bought the non-reverse Firebird.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? That's the one I meant, was the Firebird that had the ridiculous headstock on it, not the Explorer, right?
You're talking about the regular Firebird.
Yes.
The Paul Stanley kind of, Brian Jones. Right. Okay. Well, we're talking about the non-reverse Firebird.
Okay.
The other one that Brian Jones used, the one that Rundgren used. Fuck, even Weller used it.
Yeah.
Dave Gregory used it, next TC. The non-reverse Firebird, because it's so oddly shaped, you know, I knew that was a very calculated risk. But I had to have one because from the first time that I'd seen Todd Rundgren as a kid, I wanted one of those. That was like the dream rock guitar.
Right.
If I'm going to play rock guitar, I'm going to, you know, get one of those. And I got it, and sure enough, I do not look like a dick when I play it, miraculously. And I made sure I asked other people, how do I look with this? You look cool. Okay, that's all I need to know. That's more than good enough criteria for me.
Yep.
And by the way, it's light. It's funnily enough, you look at it and you're going, oh, man, no, it's light.
Right.
So that makes it so much better and great action.
But that's part of the reason why that headstock throws it so wildly out of balance is because the guitar body itself doesn't have any weight to it.
And the funny thing is that's the guitar I keep in reserve for Big Star material. Because, funnily enough, Chris Bell is in one single picture that's hard to find, but there is a rare photo of the original four-piece lineup playing live, and Chris Bell is actually using one of those guitars.
That's cool.
I had the guitar before I even saw that picture.
Well, since they came up, there is new Big Star material out this week.
Oh, is there? Oh, there is. Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's right. We were talking about music. We're not just talking about guitars and stuff.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. There is a new release that goes now into the library of Big Star, and that is the standalone version of Live at Lafayette's Music Room. And this was recorded before their now famous or infamous appearance at the Rock Writers Convention in Memphis, which is well documented both in the film Nothing Can Hurt Me and on paper and from the writers themselves who were in attendance and who are still, you know, with us and can relay the stories of that particular week in the Bluff City. But let me just say one thing, and this is not a joke. I, as a rule of thumb, I don't like live albums. I never have. And the reason for that, you know, it's always – it's some of the basic and obvious ones. Bands always sound out of tune. They play songs too fast or, you know, they kind of deconstruct them in a way that it doesn't sound like the damn song. The sound quality is not always great. It's never on par with a recorded version. But the most important thing of why I really don't like a live album is simply I don't like having the experience and joy of seeing a band live taken away by being put on a piece of vinyl or, you know, in modern parlance on CD.
Right.
You know, I like going to a show and having that memory that may not be recaptured for all to purchase.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's a reason why you spent your money on the ticket.
Right. But there are exceptions. And, you know, there I have several album live albums. Some I have that I bought as a collector of the band's music that I will never listen to, but it just had to be in there. However, with Big Star, I'm going to make an exception, because when you hear this, first of all, the restoration of these tapes is beyond phenomenal. I mean, the first and foremost, the kudos has to go to Michael Graves and to Adam Hill from Ardent for the restoration work, because there's such clarity and richness to this.
Yeah.
You know, it was originally released as part of the now out of print for the second time box set, Keep an Eye on the Sky. But you kind of gloss over that fact, to be honest with you, because there's so many other items that are going on that you're not really paying attention to. It's a live set. But the importance is the fact that whether it was the Rock Writers Convention show or this particular show, that's a full year before Radio City ever happened. So you're hearing these songs well in advance of their actual studio birth.
Right.
This lineup is Andy Hummel on bass and vocals, Alex Chilton on guitar and lead vocals, and Jody Stevens on drums and vocals. This is the lineup that recorded and gave us Radio City a year later. So that cannot even begin to be underestimated, you know,
yeah.
An afterthought. So that's number one. Number two is this band very rarely played live to begin with or jammed, save for their time in the studio. You know, theirs was never the intention of being a live performing band for whatever odd reason. You know, they had done maybe a handful of gigs when Chris Bell was in the group. You know, so you're talking about a band that at this point had a 2 year plus lifespan, and in that 2 year lifespan had played maybe 6 shows total. Okay, so that's another thing.
Yeah.
But this band goes in there as a trio and just, as the young people are wont to say, crushes it. Okay? And that's not a joke. Opening up with what else but When My Baby's Beside Me, you know? And it's really bouncy and joyful and into My Life is Right, which was originally sung by Chris Bell and now is being handled by Alex Chilton. So that's, you know, okay, marker and thumbs up number one.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Then they go into the first of what would become the Radio City songs, She's a Mover. What's important about that is on the recorded version, that's not really Big Star. That's the Dolby Fuckers. You know, that's Alex Chilton with Richard Roseborough playing drums and, you know, a couple of other people. Andy and Jody are not on the recorded version. Now, you hear this live version a year before and you think, well, what the hell? Why wasn't that lineup doing this song in the studio?
Yeah, right.
So, then you go right into another of what will be the Radio City songs, Andy Hummel's compositions sung by Jody Stevens, Way Out West, which is, you know, to this day still done in concert by Jody with just such a sense of warmth, and it was perfect. Then they go into Ballad of El Gudo and In the Street, and then Back of a Car, which, again, will be on Radio City, and that explodes. And they're playing this live a year before that recorded version, so they already had the songs mapped out. They knew where they were going to go and what they were going to do with this. And then after that comes the acoustic set. They actually had out acoustic guitars and did 13. I don't have to say more than that.
Right.
The India song, which, interestingly enough, is sung by Andy Hummel on number one record, but sung by Alex Chilton here. An interesting little change of pace, but it's a very, very happy moment. And then the very sad and mournful Try Again, which of course was sung with great pained gusto by Chris Bell on number one record, is handled here, oddly enough, by Chilton with what almost feels like an unpinning sense of possible hope. So he puts a spin on it that I don't think most people would think of.
How is the recording on this, I mean, in terms of the sound of the recording itself, because given the time period and the fact that they weren't at that point yet a top name band, does it sound okay to the ear?
It sounds not only okay, it sounds like you're actually in the room.
Wow.
It's got that kind of nuance to it and that kind of atmosphere. And What I find really interesting is that at points, as you're listening to it, the sound of the room itself comes up. You can hear the people talking, and you know, it's at first reaction, if you will, or first knee-jerk reaction, to be more accurate. You kind of go, oh, well, these people just shut up.
Like, but I usually do at concerts, yeah.
Right, instead of, you know, whipping out their cameras and so on and so forth. The room, I'm telling you right now, when you hear this, you feel like you're sitting there and watching this. And it makes it even more intimate.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
because
cool.
It's not a concert hall sound. It's a room sound. And that's the great thing about it. That's what gives it its liveliness. It's the room sound. But what makes this also really cool, just to not to get too pedantic about it, but case in point, you know, Don't Lie to Me, which is as ballsy as you're going to get on number one record, is even ballsier as just a three-piece here.
Yeah.
If you can think about that, they're down one guitar player, but boy, do they kick really hard, you know?
I'm going to have to check this out.
This does have on it, even at that point, them still doing what became big star concert staples right to the very end, them doing Hot Burrito number two, Baby Strange, the old T-Rex song, which I think I actually like the big star version better because Bolan's voice just always annoyed me.
Yeah.
And, of course, one of Chilton's favorite Todd Rundgren songs, Slut. So,
wow. Nice. So is this going to be out everywhere? I mean, can somebody pick this up wherever they get music?
You can get it right now on CD, double vinyl, and download. And if you buy the CD and or vinyl versions, there will be a download code that you can get, and you can download the first known radio interview of Big Star. It's with Alex Chilton and Andy Hummel from 1972, which I've listened to.
Excellent.
All right. And it's a lot of fun. So, yeah, this is another one that if people are going to – and I've seen people complaining about, oh, you know, trying to scrape the bottom of the barrel to release anything you can by Big Star. No, no. Anything and everything is a treasure and a find and a joy.
Good deal. Well, the last time we got together to do one of these, we were on our way to what both of us were afraid at the time and did, in fact, prove out to be the shittiest possible lineup for a Super Bowl, given the teams that were in the playoffs. I have absolutely no interest in watching this game. And given the fact that now all of the TV commercials, the one thing that draws people who don't give a shit about the teams in the Super Bowl to watching the game is the commercials and all the show around it. But they're releasing the commercials on Wednesday online. So they're saving us having to watch the game at all, and I don't think I'm going to do it.
You know, I'm kind of in two minds about it. And here's why. I know that sounds very odd to say, but the only reason why I'm in two minds is simply because at this point, after 20 years with Liz, we've always made it our tradition that we would sit and, you know, order in food and have our own little Super Bowl party. And it's always just the two of us. And she goes, look, how many of these fucking things have we watched with that asshole Brady in it? So, you know, we're not surprised that they're in it. You know, it sucks. But who knows? Maybe we'll be pleasantly shocked, which, yeah, okay, all well and good. I can't stand the Eagles. I don't give a shit.
Right.
But you know what? Okay, fine. We'll keep with tradition. So that might be the only reason why, because I don't think there's anything new on TV that's going to dare buck against it next week.
Yeah. We may just go out. I mean, we may just go out and find a nice place to have dinner that we've never been to before or go to the movies and see something we haven't seen yet. But I can't bring myself to do it because I know exactly what's going to happen. And it's the same shit that they did. And I cannot stress this enough. As a fan of a team that's in the AFC East alongside New England, you know what? If I am given an offensive line that is able to hold at will without ever having a penalty called on them for it, and I never have to worry about getting touched, I can complete passes.
There is a really cruel irony because if you remember show number 40, was it 48 or 49? It was 48 when we discussed how we had just began broadcasting as two of the best games we'd ever seen
right.
wrapped up that day. That was an apex for football.
Yeah.
You know, the sheer magnitude of Philadelphia coming back and shocking, not coming back, just shocking Atlanta, and then Jacksonville overtaking Pittsburgh. Last week were two anticlimactic games, which was just depressing. And that, of course, led to this.
Right.
This who gives a fuck Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You know, I give no shits. I don't care who's singing the national anthem.
Nope.
I don't even know who's singing the national anthem. I don't even know who the halftime act is. That's how much I don't care this year.
Yeah. Well, the halftime act is the return of Justin Timberlake following the Janet Jackson getting her boob shown on national TV thing. So, yeah, I'm with you. No, there's nothing drawing me to this game.
I don't give a shit.
Exactly. Right.
Justin Timberlake. And that's the best you could do.
One more onto the pile. So, yeah, I don't know what we're going to figure out to do, but it'll be something other than watching the Super Bowl. And this is for the first time in my life. I have never missed one of these games. I've been to two of them live. I've watched every single one of them, no matter who's in it, and I can't do it again.
There has been other things. I know it sounds weird to say, but there's been other things that are much more important in this world before the Super Bowl ever existed. So I'm sure people like us who actually have a brain in our heads will be able to get back to finding something.
There you go. And, yeah. You know, we look around in the news and,
We got to talk about the news.
Yeah, because it's gone from bad to worse. The president left the country again, so there was at least the opportunity for a little sigh of relief. But then he came back, and the government shut down for all of 24 hours. And, my take on this at the moment is that the press is so failing in its duty to protect us from this man. They're shirking their responsibility. I mean, think about this. Imagine a time ever in our nation's history where the news could have broken that the president had fucked around with a porn star while his wife was pregnant, and people go, whatever.
Well, that's part and parcel of who we've become collectively.
Yeah. Right.
On the flip side of that, I think we're already seeing that, and maybe in even more scarless way. There was a photo that came out of Obama, and I'm sure you've seen this photo now. Obama pictured with Louis Farrakhan.
Yeah.
Do you remember
him? No, sure.
Jolly guy. great at kids' parties. And it wasn't – let's put it this way. It was deliberately suppressed. The photographer decided to hand the photo over to the Congressional Black Caucus because he didn't want there to be any kinds of problems for then – potential presidential candidate and newly elected Senator Barack Obama, with possibly going on to run for the presidency, should a photo like this appear? Somebody like Farrakhan. That picture was hidden for now 13 years. And that's the explanation given, pure and simple. You know, the photographer himself admits this.
He wouldn't have won.
Or it would have been a lot harder.
Right.
But the reaction to that has been,
Yeah.
Now, when certain people that I actually know, but certain people responded with, your indifference to this is a cause for concern, is the first statement made. And the immediate reaction is, well, this is coming from Fox. So, you know, don't.
So what?
Wait. I'm actually going to read to you one of the responses because I think this speaks volumes. I don't think this is a posed photo. It happened in a second. He could have regretted being in the same space with him a minute later. Things happen fast. What I mean by don't take the bait is this is all over Fox News. It's designed to distract. And I understand this is emotional for anyone who is Jewish, but Obama has more than proved himself as a defender of all minorities. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And Farrakhan, he is so transparent. He wanted to be a musician, you know. He's not worthy of your time. You're better than this. We need your critical eye and commentary on the current administration.
No.
It's statements like that that make me clap for the current administration. Because I hate this kind of bullshit. This is false approximation that absolutely has no bearing, because this was the response, and very well stated. One, This firmly emphasizes what the learned, and I'll leave the name of the gentleman whose thread this came out under, stated above, because he himself had said, I voted Obama, but that doesn't absolve him of criticism.
Yep.
Farrakhan isn't an unknown entity with murky views. This is a man with a very powerful voice insistently teaching that Jews are responsible for the ills of the world in as grotesque and gleeful a way as ever been recorded. We would know if David Duke was at an event and to avoid him. Dismissing this as gotcha is no different than excusing Trump's very fine people white supremacy dog whistle.
Yeah, right. And that's absolutely accurate. And see, that's the problem with being above board, because there really is an extreme difficulty right now with the fact that, and of all people, Bill Maher, who I don't have any personal animus towards, but everybody I know who's ever met him hates his guts. But aside from that, he's right about this one, is that the right, what they're doing right now, and it drives me absolutely batshit crazy, is this idea that, well, you know, that's just Donald Trump. Anything in the world you can explain, well, fucking the porn star, well, it's just Donald Trump lying 2,000 times, misleading false statements to the American public in his first year in office. Well, it's just Donald Trump. Okay. First of all, that's not a defense. Second of all, yeah, that's Donald Trump, the pathological liar pussy grabber. Right. That's Donald Trump. You can't.
Not the president of the United States.
Right. You can't just say, well, that's just Donald Trump, and leave it at that. And so what happens is when you criticize, when you are to the left of center and you criticize people who are to the left of center with you, what you're doing is you're being honest about things. You're engaging in intellectual honesty by saying, yeah, you're right. Hillary Clinton was a lousy fucking candidate. Barack Obama had his issues. Nobody's perfect, but that's not an excuse. You still have to hold these people to account for their own behavior. The problem is the right doesn't do that. The right says, fuck you. He's fine. And, you know, if he lies 2,000 times, whatever, because all they're interested in is winning. And granted, nobody gets into politics to lose, but there are different ways to go about it. And the real problem is that right of center way of dealing with it is win at all costs, give Donald Trump the evangelical award. Oh, for fuck's sake. And, you know, in the same week that the porn star story comes out, and do so unabashedly and don't apologize for it. The problem is that strategy works and it wins. So you can be above board and get used to not governing, or you can, you know, say fuck everybody and be as mendacious as you want to, and you will continue to win and you will continue to rule. And that's the part that I don't know the answer to. That's what keeps me up nights.
And here's the thing with the left, because as you'll see with the response to that statement that I read to you about, you know, I don't think this is a posed photo and this is all ignorance coming out of somebody who's a lefty.
Yeah, right.
Okay. This is the chain of responses. This firmly emphasizes what the learned Mr. So-and-so stated above, the thing I just read to you about Farrakhan. Okay. And then there's a link from not Fox, not the New York Post, not any kind of right-leaning piece of journalism, but from the New York Daily News, stating very clearly that Obama took this photo and should in fact be taken to task for it.
Yep.
All there is to it's pure and simple. Pure and simple. It's not an editorial piece either. It's just, this is the photo, this is the circumstance surrounding the photo, and why this was never seen before.
Right.
End of story.
Yeah, because obfuscation is obfuscation. It doesn't matter who's doing it. And exactly. I have no more stomach for it on the left than I do on the right. But the right doesn't care.
Well, here's how you're dealing with somebody on the left. And then I'll get to another element of that in a bit. The first full-length response, why is it specifically emotional for anyone who's Jewish? Farrakhan is a well-documented hate monger, full stop.
Yep.
Obama has been held to be some paragon of virtue, which as a human being in general, he is not. And it's a posed photo. Things happen fast. Right. His regret could have been made known a few minutes later, not 13 plus years after the fact. And where or when exactly is or was a statement of regret or apology, let alone acknowledgement. And it's also on financial record that Farrakhan held numerous fundraisers for Obama's presidential campaigns. So obviously something has been kept under wraps. This, and of note, this isn't a Fox or Wright supporting press acknowledgement. This link is from the left-leaning New York Daily News. The new left leaves a chasm when perspective is called for, especially in what they've been redefining as anti-Semitism. And the gentleman who started this whole thread says, "Well-deserved criticism doesn't equal running off to Fox to find common cause. I don't suddenly abandon core principles because they happen to have been violated by somebody I like. I'm more than capable of having multiple thoughts and views simultaneously. The right has serious blind spots when it comes to white supremacy, amongst other ills, often flattering and or excusing its own obvious presence in the name of political expediency. But the left has a similar and equally serious blind spot in anti-Semitism. Both are cancerous and self-damning."
Yep. Yeah.
Now, it also goes into what we were about to talk about. What I was going to bring up in the fact that, you know, a certain person who, like last Saturday's event when nothing happened, which we won't talk about. A certain person who we won't talk about because I don't want to give him the time of day on our show, is already making intimations that he plans on running for the presidency again and failing at running at the presidency in 2020. Thus, of course, ignoring, as everyone seems to do, the fact that they should keep their eye on 2018, which is surprise now.
Yeah. Does this guy happen to also be a filmmaker?
No, unless he makes some kind of communist propaganda films.
Oh, him. Okay. I thought we were talking about Al Gore there for a second.
Oh, God forbid.
I know exactly.
Oh, wow. That's a name I hadn't even thought of. No, this person is making intimations of running for the presidency, and a friend of mine made a statement, and a lot of us made statements about what we think of him, and someone actually, her first response as a supporter of this person said, "Well, you have a lot of immature friends on here, blah, 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 and I support him." It's funny because there are so many facts readily available about this person that are out there, and yet these people will still defend him tooth and nail, but they'll insult everyone who doesn't like him or will not support him. This is how the left is going to eat itself alive.
Yeah.
And that's why the right – and I said in my response to this person, and above me is a perfect example of why we're going to get another 4 years of Donald Trump. Yeah. It's that simple. I'm putting my money on Trump because people like this and her chosen candidate – are the leading example of why these things will happen.
Right.
And you're not even going to get out of 2018 thinking you're going to win what you're going to win, because you're not.
Yeah. And it, you know, again, that goes back to the press falling down on the job, because CNN, Jeffrey Zucker, when he came in, he had this idea that the way to do it right is to pick one story and be like a rabid dog with it until the next story comes along and not pay attention to anything else. So the story that he's chosen now is impeachment and the Mueller investigation specifically. And the problem is that nothing much is happening, except a lot is happening. All of the leaks notwithstanding, Robert Mueller is doing his job. He's doing exactly what he should be doing. And all of the other crap is a distraction. And there will come an end to this story. There will be the investigation findings will come out and they will be laid in front of the Congress. And until that point, there's not a whole hell of a lot to talk about, except that there's a lot to talk about. I mean, there's the Stormy Daniels thing to talk about. There's Melania effectively leaving him while he's in the White House, you know, and that's the tabloid shit. But then there's the real stuff. For example, the headlines, if they even make it that far, about, oh, we had another record day on the Dow. We had another record day on the Dow. You know this because you've been in that world. If you're running a corporation and all you want is your stock price to go up, what's the fastest and most effective way to do it?
Give out bonuses?
Fire people.
Yeah, but you know what? You give out the bonuses and you get the tax breaks.
Yeah, right. But the reason why the Dow going gangbusters does not equal the economy going gangbusters. The economy isn't. And it's going to get even worse because the bubble that they're building right now is built on firings. And that's the part about it that's not being reported, because they're all too busy talking about the Mueller investigation, where there isn't really any news. So there's a ton of shit that's happening right now that's really detrimental to the country. When was the last time you heard a story out of Afghanistan?
This week, when suicide bombers went and attacked
the hotel.
Yeah, there were two attacks during the span of the week. There was the hotel, and then there was the one a couple of days later.
Right. When was the last time you heard something out of the war effort? I mean, we are still in a war in Afghanistan.
Right. File under can't remember.
Right. Yeah, that's a problem. And that's not the president's problem. The president likes it that way. The last president liked it that way because he promised to get us out of there and failed. So, yeah, they hate talking about that.
John, the last president, are you talking about George W. Bush, or are you talking about Barack Obama?
Barack Obama. Yeah, the guy who ran on, I'm going to get us out of Afghanistan, and had
2011 at the latest.
And had 8 years to do it and failed. So, yeah, we're still in a war, and nobody knows what's going on. Nobody acknowledges it at all.
Tell me again about how wonderful Obama is.
Right, and that's the point.
Oh, and by the way, you know, who else is thinking of throwing his hat into the ring for the presidency? That piece of shit. John Kerry.
Oh, nah.
Okay. Number one, fuck that virulent anti-Semite scumbag. Number two, no one under 65 is allowed to run for president.
Thank you. Yes.
Enough. Not that fucking gas bag. Not that lurch-looking bastard. Not Grandpa Biden. He's already lost his marbles. Forget it. Just go home, plugs, and stay there.
Right.
Okay? Never mind that drooling commie prick whose name I won't mention. Okay? Not Pocahontas, because she's a fucking liar and an idiot to boot. Okay? Not, yeah, I used to be good, and I did, in fact, run into burning buildings, and I cleaned up Newark, but then I made shit up as I went along, and I can't speak publicly.
Yeah.
And I'm riding the Sanders train. Fuck that guy, too, now. Oh, and anyway the wind blows, I'll vote for Kirsten Gillibrand. I used to be a Republican Kirsten Gillibrand.
Uh-huh.
Fuck you too, sweetheart.
Right. Well, if your claim to fame is that you lost to the dumbest fucker we have ever had hold office, then no, you don't get to run again. Sorry.
Well, the pickings are slim. That's yeah, for certain.
Right.
That's for certain. But, you know, in this lovely country of ours, we have the joy and the honor and the privilege and the blessing of freedom of speech, and because we are an open and free trading society, we are allowed to create businesses, and that's encouraged and applauded. But when you take a symbol like the yellow star,
oh,
that was in Nazi Germany, you know, with the word Jude on it.
Yeah.
And you use it and say the words gun owner as your badge of persecution. I got a problem with you.
Yeah.
I got a problem. You know what? And I'm saying this in all seriousness. I got a problem with you even if I wasn't a Jew.
Sure.
I got a problem with you because I'm a fucking American. I'm a human being. And I don't like when you people do that because it makes you cheapen anything and everything that is good about this country.
Yeah. Not to mention, and you're right, if folks miss the story, it's out of St. Peter's, Missouri, which is from where I'm sitting about a 45-minute drive. It's a lily white suburb of St. Louis. It goes St. Louis City, then St. Louis County, then St. Charles County. That's where St. Peter's is. So this is the white flight area. And these jackasses got these stars, and there's two different versions of them. Both of them are six-pointed stars of David. One is the yellow one that says gun owner, saying that effectively the point behind this is, oh, gun owners are so persecuted, they're just like the Jews in 1930s Germany. Horseshit they are. Back to that in a second. The other star is a white star, go figure, that says Republican on it. Again, effectively, oh, the poor downtrodden Republicans in fucking St. Charles County, really? I mean, please lay out to me how persecuted the white man is in St. Charles County, Missouri. I'm sure it's just as persecuted as he is on Staten Island.
Hey, now, wait a minute. Now, hold on a second there, son. Okay? You're talking about Shaolin. I represent. Do not be talking shit about Shaolin. I
now
you with a quickness.
The yeah, but the gun owner thing. I mean, this horse shit. And that's, I mean, there's this phony persecution complex, and we've heard about it from the Christian right for 20 years now. or more, actually going back to the early 80s, we heard about the persecution complex from the Christian right, because obviously with two or three churches on every street corner, life's really tough for Christians in this country. They're so downtrodden and so put upon at every possible juncture, let alone the fact that you run down the rolls in Congress and in the Senate and tell me how many white Christians you have in there by percentage. So obviously, yeah, that's a load of bullshit.
And the only time you want to use the Jews is to for your own gains, because otherwise you want to get rid of them.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You're talking about the rapture this and the rapture that.
But, you know, for gun owners to say they're persecuted in this country, oh, get a fucking life. I mean, just stop. This idea that somehow everybody's coming down on you because somebody wants you to be accountable for your own actions. Oh, boy, life's tough. I mean, you know, and these are the people who love to throw around that term precious snowflake. There are no more precious snowflakes in this country than white Republican gun owners. Oh, I'm so persecuted. I'm so put upon. Get a fucking life. Grow some balls, asshole.
Well, here's the thing. The snowflakes are the Republicans on the right who like to do that kind of shit. The precious petals are all the douchebag cockknockers and assholes on the left.
Right.
You know, so that's how you can delineate one from the other. You know, you got the snowflakes on the right.
Now we know the players, yeah.
And we got the and the precious petals on the left, because that's every piece of shit under the sun over there. But, you know, the other thing is about these fucking gun owners. All we're asking for responsible gun owners to do is be responsible for their fucking guns.
Right.
I don't know why that gets lost in simple translation.
Yeah.
If I wanted to purchase a gun as an American citizen, I have the right to do that. As an American citizen with no police record or anything negative, I want to purchase a gun for my own peace of mind and safety of my house. I can do so.
Right.
That doesn't mean I'm going to go walking around packing the fucking thing in my belt because now I got a gun, so now it makes my dick 6 inches bigger than the foot that it already is. I got enough shit to drag around my leg. I ain't going to drag another goddamn gun around with me. That's ridiculousness. It's calling for simple responsibility, and yet, that does not seem to translate in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Put in the most simplistic manner, as you and I just did, and we're not lawmakers, for God's sakes. Now, at the same time, there was another school shooting this week.
Yep.
A girl died. Did anybody even give that any time of day on the news?
No. They were too busy talking about Mueller.
No, exactly. Mueller this, Mueller that, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
Okay? That's a major league problem, and that's the press. But let's wrap up the thing about the Jewish star, because it goes back into everything we were talking about before with that whole Farrakhan and Obama thing. You know, whether it's using the Jewish star as a proverbial flag of convenience,
yeah,
you know, or you know, somebody showing a photo of Obama with Farrakhan, you know, I find it ironic. And not in a funny or even slightly wry way, that all this happened during, you know, the days leading up to Holocaust Remembrance Days.
Right.
You know, isn't that odd?
Yeah, and boy, I can't wait to hear what Donald Trump has to say for Holocaust Remembrance. But yeah, it's so bad, and people refuse to look at the world with any kind of glance of reality. And it drives me absolutely crazy. Everything, you know, people talk about the polarization while they're adding to it. And you know, all you have to do is step back and say, does this make any sense? Do the comparisons that people are making have any basis in reality? And if they don't, walk away, because that guy's an asshole.
You know what? I think at this point, honestly, if you took Donald Trump out of the picture, I think what his election, or you know, not even his election, but his rise, or maybe it was just the entire scope of the 2016 elections, because let's face it, the comrade disciples are just as repugnant, if not more so,
yep,
than Trump's people. Because here's the thing that I can't help but emphasize over and over again. With Trump and with the right, you know what to expect. I'm sorry, there's no surprises here. There is none. You know what you're going to get.
They're not smart enough to surprise anybody.
Right. It's going to come either hard and fast, or you're going to sit there and be able to go, okay, you know, listen, there are things that you've said over the last 2 years on the shows that we've done that predicted very clearly what was going to happen. And sure enough, those things happen. It's not like you're Karnak and you're sitting there with a fucking crystal ball. It's the fact that there's a predictability factor involved with the Republicans. But with the left, that's where it gets far more nebulous and far more murky. And that's a big thing with the left, is they're good at creating a smokescreen for everything. And that's why I don't trust them anymore.
Yeah.
And in fact, on Monday, I did in fact send in my re-registration to the New York City Board of Elections to remove me from the Democratic Party and just leave me with no party affiliation.
Yeah.
Because they are in and of themselves cancerous. Well, and until the Democratic Party weeds itself out of all these lunatics – and these extreme leftists, and just, no, you don't have a place in this party, and then actually sets themselves an agenda and a clear-cut course, they're not going anywhere. So that's why subsequently, this year they're not going to win anything big. They're not going to take the House or the Senate or both, and they're certainly not going to win back the White House in 2020. That's a fact. You can see it. They're in shambles.
They have nothing new to say. And you know, as an avowed Marxist, I always have to defer to Groucho. And he said, I refuse to be a member of any organization that would have somebody like me as a member. So, yeah, screw them all.
just remember, he also said, let me slip out of these wet things and into a dry martini.
Right. And of course, you know, when it comes to education, just remember that outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
All right. Buy a duck, buy no chicken. All right, buy a duck. All right, buy a duck.
All right, so with that, we can get it in our heads because I've had it with a lot of them. But the in our heads thing this week, I once again went back to because I got to turn somebody onto this song. As a matter of fact, it's the producer for my radio show. One of the first things I started talking about when we got to talking about putting the show together was all of the music stuff. And somehow Tim Curry's brilliant I Do the Rock came up. And he had never heard it before. So I said, oh, yeah, this is great. And he said, I'm a huge fan of Tim Curry's work in the movies, because this kid's also a movie critic. And so I played him the song, and he said, it makes me so happy that that exists.
Baby Ruth and Dizzy Dean, Best and Paul and Audrey, Little Mo, Virginia Wade, Disco Pete and OJ. I've always liked DiMaggio, and Rockman's pretty cute, you know. I could never wear. Such velocity, I do the round. I do the round. I do the round. And I can get it. And stimulate him. I'm a keen student.
He's become a huge fan of it now, too. And I thought, you know, it's funny because I was a little surprised that there was no real follow-up to that. The fact that it has the verse in there about John and Yoko, and it's such a product of its time, because that was 1979. That song came out less than a year before John was murdered. So I think it was hard to play that one later on, talking about them in the present tense. So it became a sort of a victim of that, and there was never a follow-up hit for Tim Curry. But it started me to thinking about the other times when somebody who is outside of the music industry got the opportunity to make something. And sometimes it's been horrible and sometimes it's been great, but explore with me the non-musicians' songs that end up on the pop charts, or is even songs that just end up making some kind of a splash from people who came from making movies, making TV shows, comedians who have done songs. There's all kinds of them out there. What do you like?
The very first one that comes to my mind, because it's just a really cute and sweet song, is Johnny Angel by Shelley Fabre.
Yes, yes. And she's adorable too, so.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, God, she was the girl you couldn't help but fall in love with immediately.
Johnny Angel, how I love him. He's got something that I can't resist, but he doesn't even know. Johnny Angel, how I want him, how I tingle when he passes by. Every time he says hello, my heart begins to fly.
So cute, but it was a really sweet song. It's catchy, you know. If you go back to the earliest, what do we want to call it? The earliest of the pop charts, when Debbie Reynolds, who was an actress, obviously,
yep,
had a hit, like a number one hit with a song like Tammy, you could start there as your jumping off point. But as far as the ones that I like and remember, certainly, Johnny Angel is just a really cute song. I'm really fond of that. Something that wasn't technically music industry on the whole, the Chipmunks.
Right, right. I mean, that was, yeah, the cartoon.
Whether it's David Seville doing, you know, the Witch Doctor song or then the Chipmunk song and Alvin's harmonica. I mean, look, I'm 53 years old and in my head is still the Alvin Show.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, again, going back to 1979, 1980, you could not turn on a pop station and not hear Rick Springfield. And this guy was a soap star long before he was a music star.
And before that, he was actually a cartoon star.
Oh, really? Because
when he was, dare I say, imported here from Australia, where he was something of a rock star, mm-hmm. he was touted as being, you know, another teen bopper idol. But that didn't really happen. But there was he was aligned with – I can't remember the name of the cartoon show, but it was one of those terrible Filmation series. You remember Filmation.
Sure.
They did lousy cartoon shows. But there was a cartoon show that they had him as the lead character and lead voice, and there was always a song in there and some kind of nonsense. But okay. So when that kind of fell apart, he really didn't do much of anything and then went back to acting, straight acting. Wound up playing Dr. Noah Drake on General Hospital. Lo and behold, somebody at RCA Records said, hey, you know what? Why don't you come in and cut some tracks? And Jesse's Girl became a massive hit and restarted his whole music career all over again.
Yep.
Because she's watching him with those eyes. And she's loving him with that body. I just know it. And he's holding her in his arms late at night.
But he was somebody who had the goods. He could deliver both. He could act and he could sing. So he's kind of an exception to the rule. Now, another one, or actually another couple that we're going to go right into, if you take it at face value, and this is purely at face value, the Monkees.
Yeah, right. Yeah, musicians. There were two of them who were musicians beforehand.
Technically three. Mickey Dolenz was, in fact, the lead singer and guitarist in a band called, ironically, The Missing Links.
But even before that, he was Circus Boy.
That's true. Which, of course, if you've ever watched The Monkees and the episode Monkees at the Circus, very clever in-joke.
Yep.
He walks around singing the song. He's like, and Peter keeps Mike asks him, what is that? Like, I don't know, some old TV song, TV thing. I don't know, some old TV show. I don't know. He keeps doing his whole. But, you know, he was Circus Boy. Davy Jones was, of course, in Oliver Twist.
Right.
And was, in fact, on the episode of the Ed Sullivan Show where the Beatles made their first appearance.
And, of course,
1964.
Right. And on the dark side of this theme, of course, there's that time when Vicki Lawrence won a Grammy for The Night the Lights Went Out in Georgia.
Yes. Who was the shooter? Was it Andy? Never got the answer,
you know,
to that.
I got Madonna's big dick in one ear, and I got Toby Wong, the fucking Jap, in the other. Oh, man. Now we're going back to Reservoir Dogs. Great.
Toby Wong? Toby Chong? Charlie fucking Chan? You know what? I changed my mind. Shoot this prick.
Oh, I love Harvey Keitel.
You shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize.
Best tough guy line in any movie ever, for my money. But yeah, and you know, there were George Burns had a couple of songs that were
the Archies. How's about that? Because the Archies weren't even human.
Right. Right.
That was a cartoon, people, in case you don't know that.
It was a cartoon. Sugar, sugar.
It was a comic book and it was a cartoon series on CBS. Another shitty Filmation show, actually. Duh.
Yeah, and before Sean Cassidy was a pop star, he was the star of the Hardy Boys.
And, of course, then right after that, we had the Partridge Family.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, you had that period. So leading up to, you know, the point where Tim Curry is, let's jump right back before Tim Curry. Rick Dees, a DJ, has a hit with Disco Dunk.
Flapping my arms, I begin to cluck. Look at me, I'm the disco nut. Ah, let's go, mama. I got the bills, mama.
Yeah, well, he wasn't. Remember, he wasn't the first DJ to have a hit song either. There was that plane crash in 1959 that took J.P. Richardson away from us.
Yeah, but he already had the hit on the charts when he died.
Yeah, but he was a DJ. He was just a radio disc jockey long before he put Chantilly Lace together.
Which most people don't realize. If we're talking about J.P. Richardson, we're talking about the Big Bopper.
The Big Bopper, deal. Right, yeah.
You know, but that's, you know, it's another thing. But then again, you know what? Here's one for you. You might know this one because you know this kind of stuff, but a radio DJ turned game show host had a hit record with a song, with a, not so much of a sung song, but a narrative called Deck of Cards.
Yes.
Wink Martindale.
Wink Martindale. And later on, he was Tic Tac Doe. He hosted that show.
Among so many others. Yes, indeed. Yep. So, you know, you have to keep in mind something, especially if you listen to this show and you're of our age range. You remember that it was an endless array of possibilities who could have a hit record. You can't even fathom that idea now.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't. Because back then, the charts were filled with things like Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler with The Ballad of the Green Berets hitting number one in 1966.
Fighting soldiers. Yeah, right.
Is a one by one. You know, Semper Fi, do or die.
You got it. That's man. We'll leave it at that and ask you for some more of them if you can think of some more uncharted territory for non-pop stars who ended up there. Then by all means, put it in the comment section at the bottom of this here page. And Rob Ross, next time we talk, we will be on the doorstep of that football game I'm not going to watch.
Correct. And, you know, we'll even do it during game time.
Yeah.
How's about that? That's how we spend that football game Sunday.
There you go. Screw you, NFL. Have a great week.
You too, brother. I'll see you next week.